Today is Wednesday. It's January 5th, 2022. Hi, it's John Williams. It's 2:46 in the afternoon, and this is the Mincing Rascals. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN from 10 a.m. This is my all-new time until 2 p.m.
Hey, it's John Hansen from Block Club Chicago and also WGN Radio, and I have a cold.
I'm Heather Sharone from WTTW News, and I do not have a cold, thankfully.
I'm Austin Bird from the Illinois Policy Institute. No cold.
And I'm Eric Zorn, the grouchy publisher of the Picayune Sentinel and occasional columnist for the Daily Herald.
I wonder if we should all sign on each day with our medical condition. Tested, not tested, vaxxed, non-vaxxed. I sound like I've got COVID. It's really the cold, that sort of thing.
I don't know why I'm so defensive about it, but every time anyone asks, I'm like, I've been tested. I'm negative. What does it matter? At this point, I'd rather have checked the box off and be positive, I think.
Well, you can, and also you can be contagious and still test negative.
True.
Right? At least for a while, maybe the whole time.
And I also think you can test positive and not be contagious.
Oh, definitely that.
Too. Yes. So there's that. You know, Northwestern put out a bulletin today that said some of you are thinking about just ripping off the Band-Aid, sort of. That is, go out, get Omicron, be done with it, and not have that nagging worry hanging over your head. They said, please don't do that.
Well, you don't know you're going to get one of the mild cases. Most people I know have gotten fairly mild cases and have not had to go to the hospital. But certainly, we've seen by the hospital statistics, the occupancy statistics, the lack of ICU beds and so on, that there are a number of people who are going to get it. So if everyone went out and decided to get it right now, the hospitals and medical care facilities would be overwhelmed. Yeah. And that would be bad.
Like a chickenpox party or something?
Exactly.
Yeah, I was just going to say that every time somebody says something like that, I think about my friends who have kids younger than five who can't be vaccinated and are at highest risk for bad outcomes. And I cringe because you might be okay, but it's really hard to be sure that you don't give it to anybody else because it's so transmissible. It's playing with fire.
I almost hesitate to ask, Eric, but why are you grouchy today?
I'm grouchy because MAGA usurped my birthday a year ago. My birthday is January 6th, tomorrow, Thursday.
How do I not know that?
Well, because I usually don't make a big deal of it because January 6th, nobody cares about parties or anything. January 6th, they've had Thanksgiving, they've had Christmas, they've had New Year's. No one wants another party. So it was okay. And now, and then there was the insurrection last year. And I think, well, okay, bad things happen on a lot of dates. But then shorthand for that entire grotesque event all year has been January 6th. There hasn't been, you know, been any number of terrible news events happen and don't get associated with dates. This has become like a new day of infamy. It's not obviously as bad as 9/11, at least not yet. But it's one of those dates that is immediately shorthand for something terrible happened. And they stole this from me. And I'm grouchy about that.
I would say 9/11, 1/6, Pearl Harbor. What else? There aren't many days that live in infamy like that.
See, well, and let's ask the youngest member of our panel, Austin. Does December 7th like ring a bell for you, Austin? See, yeah, that's Pearl Harbor Day. But John, you and I are kind of old, and that's why that happens. But I think December 7th has faded for most people, except for the World War II generation. November 22nd is another one. Right?
November 22nd?
Yep. Yeah.
Oh, no, wait a minute.
Kennedy, but that didn't have the ring. The date didn't have, like, the ring, I don't think, of, like, the Kennedy assassination.
What was November 22nd?
Kennedy assassination. I mean, it definitely did in my family. My parents moved their wedding day so that it wasn't the 22nd because their extended family rejected the entire notion of a celebration on that day.
Oh, wait. They moved their wedding from the specific day it was or from another year subsequent?
No, they got married in like 1975 or something.
Okay. Still wouldn't. Wow.
Right.
Wow.
By the way, just for the record, I did hear about Kennedy's assassination. I was aware of it, but right. What dates resonate? And for me, it's December 7th, 9/11, January 6th. That'd be the big awful tree.
So another reason for me to hate Trump.
Oh yeah, and by the way, you think that's why they did it, Eric? Because they know you.
Spies. Yeah, spite. Pure spite. They could have done it any day.
Luckily in this country, you just have to wait another year for some other horrible date to come along, Eric, and then we'll usurp that one.
Well, don't tell him this, but I think January 6th this year might just pay more dividends of crap for Eric because...
Well, yeah. Trump did cancel his news conference yesterday. I guess some of his supporters talked him out of it. They thought this is just going to be a bad look. It's just going to remind people of the day and your connection to it, so...
The Chicago Public Schools say the schools are safe. The teachers union says not safe enough. There was no learning at the largest school district in the state. Is Chicago Public Schools the second largest in the country?
Third.
New York, LA?
Yes.
CPS says the CTU's refusal to work Wednesday is an illegal work stoppage, and the teachers will lose today's pay. Whatever it is, teachers are locked out of their accounts. And the question to me isn't, what would I do with my kid? Though I think I'd send them to school right now. But what should the decision be for a body of 330,000 students, knowing that some of them, maybe tens of them, maybe more, will get sick?
It's tough. It's tough. And I'm glad I'm not the decider for 300,000 kids. But there are a couple things happening here. One is sort of the political side of this, and that is the extreme lack of trust between the teachers union and Mayor Lori Lightfoot, which dates back to day one, hour one, second one of her administration. So they were already operating, even under the best circumstances, at a significant trust deficit. I hope I will have the capacity and mental fortitude to write about this soon, but I really think that the crucial decision made by Mayor Lori Lightfoot that brought us to this point was her decision in the fall, August, to not reach a safety agreement with the Chicago Teachers Union. And for a while, that worked because COVID was, for better or for worse, relatively under control. But it was no longer tenable once the Omicron surge really hit Chicago. And without that lack of clear metrics on what the rules would be in terms of testing, in terms of quarantining, in terms of vaccinations, it all fell apart. And that's what happened yesterday. And that's why we were all up until midnight to try to figure out if there was going to be school today.
Can I interrupt you just a second, Heather? Yeah. You seem to blame Mayor Lightfoot for this. And no. I don't remember what it seems like. This is something that both sides should have done at that time.
It does take two sides to reach an agreement. And the union said, let's continue the safety agreement that we had in place last year. So last year, there was an agreement that if the city went over 15% test positivity, all of the schools would switch to remote learning. That agreement expired at the end of last year. And the union said, look, let's continue that agreement. Let's put that agreement back in place. And the mayor refused. She said, no, we've got vaccinations now. We don't need that agreement. And the union said, okay, we really think that we do need an agreement. And they renewed that call after several teachers died of COVID after teaching in person. And the mayor refused. And I asked the mayor about this yesterday. I asked CEO Pedro Martinez, do you regret not having an agreement? And he said, no, we didn't need one in the fall, which wasn't really what I was asking, is did you need one for something like this happening? And they thought that they didn't. And it was essentially a gamble that COVID would not get this bad this fast. And truly, they lost.
I got to ask, because I asked the VP, Stacey Davis Gates, last week on December 27th on WGN, when no one was talking about this. I'm sure you were, Heather, but no one was paying attention to this. But it was still a week away from the start of school, and everyone knew this was going to be a huge problem 7 full days before school started again. Would you consider a complete pause to all learning, virtual or in school, take a 2-week break and just tack it at the end of the summer? And she wouldn't even go there. And I have no idea why that wasn't what has been the ultimate decision, like the easiest thing in the world.
I don't think that would have been easy at all, because then you're dealing with parents angry that summer vacation has been disruptive. And I can tell you that since the mayor was yesterday unwilling to even consider a 2-week pause now, when the test positivity is more than 23%. There's no way that the mayor is saying, let's keep our kids in school until July 1st, which is essentially what that would mean.
But John's suggestion is right. I mean, it's going to happen. I mean, why not anticipate it? Why not plan?
That's the point I'm making, is that this was foreseeable. I think everybody can say, right? And there was a lack of planning to sort of say, if the worst happens, what do we do?
When you were on the radio with us today, Austin,
I'm particularly critical
of the union.
I'm extremely critical of the union. And of course, CPS has a history of terrible mismanagement and incompetence, and it's a failed bureaucracy in many ways. That doesn't let the CTU off the hook for what they're doing. And I go back to, and Heather did a great job live tweeting this, and she has been throughout the last few days, has been a boss on this issue in particular. Arwady essentially said two things. One, kids are safer in school. Two, if you are vaxxed and boosted up to age 65, you are at near zero risk of hospitalization. Closing schools is not an evidence-based mitigation for COVID at this point. It's simply not. And the fact that that isn't being called out from the CTU's perspective, that what they're doing is completely not evidence-based as a COVID mitigation measure, is entirely due to the fact of their politics, which is that they're radically left. But what they're doing isn't evidence-based. It's hurting kids. There's 340,000 kids out of school today, many of them who do not have COVID. I just was texting with a teacher who was by himself today at a school on the West Side. None of his kids tested positive for COVID, and none of them are in school. That's an unacceptable outcome for Chicago. And I think CTU deserves enormous criticism.
One point I want to ask Austin and Heather and whoever else wants to jump in. Yes, I agree that it's a terrible mitigation strategy because... or the idea that you're going to, here's my question. What about all these schools that have teacher shortages? Because if you test positive for COVID, you shouldn't be there. So if it's 30% of your staff, that's why I recommend just everyone go to your own camp for 2 weeks until we sort this out.
If their vote was, say, successful and CPS said, all right, great, let's go all remote. Because just for background, CTU voted, do we go remote for 2 weeks? And they voted yes. 73% of members voted yes.
I'll correct you just a little bit. So the vote technically was until CPS agrees to a safety plan or the test positivity is below 15%. So there's no timeline on it. There's no doubt that there's nobody saying, you know, that there's that going remote is needed at this point in terms of like a health official. CTU would argue, well, sure, but there's a whole raft of other things that we've asked CPS to do, including advanced testing, more vaccination efforts, better masks for students that are recommended that CPS has refused to do.
And I think CTU's argument there is extremely hard to believe based on the experiences of almost every other large city in the country, none of which are completely remote. LA delayed opening by a bit, not by 2 weeks, by a bit. Every other big city school district in the country of the top 15 largest cities, none of them are fully remote. And John, right. to your point,
I just have to point out, it's the even-handed person in me, that both LA and New York have significantly different and more robust testing, masks, and quarantine policies than right. Chicago has in place now.
There are other big school districts besides New York and LA. There's, you know, 12 other sure. those big ones.
And a lot of mid-range school districts, Atlanta, Detroit, are fully remote. So you got to compare. You either got to say, well, Chicago shouldn't be remote because big city districts aren't. And then you got to say, well, what are those districts doing that Chicago isn't? It's testing, it's masks, it's different quarantine rules. And then you say, well, then it shouldn't be remote. Well, then you look at districts like Detroit and Atlanta, but they are remote. So we got to compare apples to oranges here.
It's a huge stretch for the CTU to say the CPS is actually so much more incompetent, so much worse than all these other big city school districts that we can't go to school. And Arwady's two points still remain, regardless of the testing, regardless of vaccination status, regardless of a union bargained agreement. One, kids are safer in school. And two, if you are vaxxed and boosted up to age 65, as almost every
I think 91% of CPS staff 92. Is, you are at near zero risk of hospitalization. And those two facts make this completely indefensible to me.
To me, I said the easy solution was 2 weeks at home. Obviously, that's not easy. I guess I meant the obvious solution. For me, it's a matter of staffing. If you, and we're seeing this in all sorts of different sectors, whether it's travel, whether it's for healthcare. I mean, some people are losing 15 to 20% of their staff right now. There's not substitute teachers to be there. So that is the grievance, I guess, I understand the most, is that teachers are like, look, we can't be in the classroom if we're COVID positive, even if we're asymptomatic for 5 days. There's a huge spike in these cases right now. Heather, you do the great counts every day about our positivity rate. But we also look to other cities and other places that have had Omicron, and which I still continue to pronounce wrong. And they have cratered after a couple weeks. Cratered. This is not going to be a long wave. And I understand that going to school in July is abhorrent to people's psyche for some reason. And I understand that it's against what teachers may want to do in their vacation plans. But we've canceled police's vacations for how many times so far this year? This is a strange circumstance. You can keep the schools open with administrators like they are today to still feed kids that rely on schools for their meals and just have everyone go to their corner. And it, at the very least, it gives you 2 weeks or a week and a half or whatever it is to decide what the next plan is.
And before we start talking about how great CPS is, remember that they sent out 150,000 take-home COVID-19 tests. Only 35,000 of them were completed. And you see, you know, there were the FedEx boxes that were teeming with envelopes that people were trying to send them. To send them in, and then 25,000 of those that got sent in were ruined. So they only had, of that original 150,000, they had 10,800 that could be processed, and 18% of them were positive. So it's like, it was a crap show, right? And so that's one of the reasons that I think that the union is like, this school district doesn't have its act together here. And I think that's kind of part of what you're seeing here, is the sense that they don't really know what they're doing. And then you've got these conflicting messages coming over. I mean, I'm coming more toward Austin's point of view on this, which is it's time to get back to school, and we can't keep everybody safe, but this is probably for the best for society, for the kids, for, you know, if you look at the huge picture, this is probably the best way to do it. I don't think it's an easy decision. I think it's difficult for the adults who are going to be in the classroom and getting exposed to the germs from 25 different families at the same time. But you have to realize that CPS did not acquit itself well at all with this testing program.
I think it's important to note that these problems with testing in the schools didn't start over Christmas vacation. It started day one of the school year. And if you remember back in August, before Pedro Martinez was hired, the district promised to test every student. So that's like 330,000 students every week. And the district has not managed to test more than 30,000 students per week. So there were a lot of parents that I've spoken to who said, look, I relied on that promise to send my kid back. And when that never materialized for a host of reasons, including the fact that tests became extremely hard to find just when cases started to rise, funny how that happens, that they felt like they couldn't trust what was coming from CPS. And so it was not only parents that felt that, but it was, you know, staff and teachers who were going into those buildings every day, potentially being exposed to COVID. And in some cases, and in some schools, seeing their colleagues and friends get sick, and in several cases die. You know, you can debate, you know, sort of who was right and who was wrong and that sort of thing. But I think it's important to know that we are all sitting, you know, socially distanced away, not at peril of COVID. And we were asking these teachers who have families and children of their own to expose themselves under the authority of a district that they deeply, deeply distrusted. And when you have this sort of surge, all of that trust sort of can, you know, break down. And that's where we are, why we are here. I missed those prepositions, but you get what I meant.
One potential solution for this, because I think obviously the trust between CTU and CPS is broken. I think that is largely due to CPS's incompetence. It's partially due to the fact that CTU for the last 10 years has had very radical ideological leadership that wants to make everything political and doesn't see things as just a contract fight. They see it as part of a larger ideological and political project, which is always going to produce extreme conflict and extreme distrust of our elected officials who they bargain with and fund their opponents. In Arizona, if your public school closes now due to a law that Governor Ducey signed, you get the money that would have gone to your kid in the school, and you can take it elsewhere and do what you will with it. Hmm. And I think that's fair. Some parents maybe support what CTU is doing. That's fine. Their kid won't go to school. Other parents desperately need a place for their child to go, and CPS has a monopoly on public schooling. And that's unfair to those parents. So they should get the money that we pay for schooling, and they should be able to decide what they do with it. That money doesn't belong to CPS or CTU if schools aren't operating.
It's a really innovative legislative wedge, isn't it? I haven't heard that kicked around here in Illinois, Austin.
Yeah, I don't think it'll be kicked around here anytime soon. But we do, I should mention, we do have a great school choice program that is pretty relatively small compared to other states. It's called Invest in Kids. And you can get a tax credit scholarship that you can take if you're a low-income family. There's a very long waiting list. It's very limited. J.B. Pritzker tried to kill the program twice. And you can send a kid to the school of your choice with that money if you don't feel like your current school is serving you well. And that's a great program and should be expanded. And programs like that have been expanded on a bipartisan basis in many states, and we should expand ours.
Like, I did want to mention one thing that you made me think of, John Hansen, and that is in the CPS statement about this COVID argument they're having with the union right now, they included what the incentives are for substitute teachers. Wouldn't matter if you can't get people into the building, even if both sides agreed. So if you work 12 days or more in a month, you get a $420 stipend. If you work in a high-need school, you get an extra $45 a day. If you're willing to work between now and the middle of the month, they'll give you an extra $30 a day. They're just doing anything they can to get somebody to show up. Even though, you were right, Austin, 91% of the faculty and staff have been vaccinated in CPS.
Before we move on, Jen, I have one question. I think it's so easy, and I think so many people are just so peeved off at both sides, maybe even equally. Yep. And I'm so sick of battles between CPS and CTU that seem to rage every single year. Is there some other big city that has a, I don't want to dive into this too deeply, but that does not have a system that is set up the way it is? And I know, is it the school board election, but like, what is it about Chicago that makes this a battle seemingly every darn year?
Okay, this is where Heather and Austin do their apples and oranges.
Okay, well, if you had this,
all right, I got my. Here's my theory.
Okay, well, this was actually going to it. Sorry to go on a tangent.
Well, very briefly. So this, I think there's two factors. One is legislatively, we give such broad power to government sector unions in Illinois, more broad power than most other even heavily Democratic states. That's one problem. And actually, in I believe it was April of last year, J.B. Pritzker signed a law expanding CTU's scope of bargaining. So they can bargain over anything. They can strike over many, many different things. They have extraordinarily broad power, very large membership, $30 million plus dollar budget. It's extremely powerful. That plus the fact that in 2010, a group of very far left individuals, part of the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, took leadership positions at every step of CTU leadership. They were elected because the previous leadership was seemingly a bit incompetent and also split the ticket that year. So they had two kind of incumbents running against each other, plus Caucus of Rank and File Educators. And they have really transformed the union into a political and ideological force that is going to be very militant and very combative and sees itself as sort of the tip of the spear for far left labor movements across the country. And I think that's going to produce a lot of conflict for a long time.
So I don't necessarily think that's wrong. I would point out that CTU's bargaining rights are now on par with every other teachers union in the state. And that was not the case until Governor Pritzker signed that piece of legislation. So it's important to know that, like, CTU doesn't have extra rights or more power than any other teachers union. The other thing is I don't think it's correct to cast the current leadership of the union as sort of out of step with previous versions of the union's leadership, because there's a reason that CTU is Local One. This was one of the very first unions to organize teachers. It is sort of the cradle of the teachers movement going back decades. And if you grew up like I did in Chicago and went to public schools, you suffered through a series of strikes led by the CTU, led by Jackie Vaughn, who in some ways made Karen Lewis look like a milquetoast moderate. And, different issues, of course. But there's a reason why former Mayor Daley went to the state legislature and got control of the district in 1995. The fact of the matter is that it is always been a force in Chicago politics. It has always been sort of a base that Chicago officials have had to reckon with. And I think there's probably an argument to be made that much of the city's long-term financial problems stems from Richard Daley giving the union significant pay increases and benefit increases to ensure labor peace. So now we've had two mayors since Daley who have pushed back against that power, pushed back from that CTU, from that sort of union power. And I think this is the reasonable result of that, amplified and made tougher by the pandemic. And I think probably the personal enmity between Lori Lightfoot and people like Stacey Davis Gates.
We are 3 days now into the Vax card system for Cook County and the city of Chicago, right? Have you guys been out enough to know how well it's going? I'm thinking anecdotally here. I guess that's the only way to really talk about this.
I haven't been checked once now that I think of it.
Have you been out? Have you gone into a restaurant?
I've a couple of places that would have asked, I think, did not.
Really? What are the names of these places? What I was hearing from people was like the health clubs they were going to and a couple of restaurants that they were asked. They showed their card. Some people stormed off. But by and large, it was working like you thought it would. People generally comply. People are largely vaccinated. So this isn't a great hardship. It's not been a big flashpoint.
I haven't left the house in 5 or 6 days, but I did go on a long walk. There's signs there. No, it's a cold.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I got checked when I went to the gym early Monday morning, and it took about, a grand total of 30 seconds out of my life. And I know that I felt more comfortable and was surprised by the number of regulars who I have overheard at my gym complaining about vaccines and vaccine requirements, who had no trouble presenting their card and getting access to it. I don't know that it's going to move the needle significantly one way or the other in terms of like forcing people to get vaccinated, but it might. But
I don't think that's its purpose either.
Yeah. Well, the mayor has said that that's what she hopes.
John, I think it clearly is the purpose. The main point here is to inspire people to get vaccinated. They think like, I can't go to the restaurant. I can't go to the gym. Oh, hell with it. I'll get vaccinated. I can't go to a play. I can't go to a ball game. And so that is, I think, the entire point of this. I don't think there's any, I don't think the fact that everybody is vaccinated in a restaurant or in a gym is really going to make much of a dent in public safety as such in that particular environment. But I think it's definitely the reason why they're doing it. It's a carrot. Essentially, it's a carrot, right?
I think businesses wanted it. And now the mayor is the bad person that did it, and she'll take the heat for it.
But I mean, at the end of the day, okay, so maybe I'm wrong about the motivation, but as a person, look, there's more of us that will spend our money there than won't as a result of this. So I don't see it as an effective carrot. I don't know that this will persuade those people. Maybe it will. Maybe it will, but it'll sure make it easier for me to spend money in a bar, in a gym, at a movie theater. I haven't gone to a movie theater since COVID began because I thought, I'm not doing that. But maybe now I would.
I'm in the same boat as you.
My only experience with this was when we were in New York a couple months ago. And in New York City, they've been doing this for a while. And every place we went, every coffee shop, every play we went to, everything we did, they checked, and it was very smoothly done. And it took an extra 2 minutes sometimes. And I didn't see anybody complaining about it. I've seen reports on TV newscasts that there are customers who are getting their knickers in a twist over it. But in general, it's a very easy thing to comply with. You have your card, you show your card, yeah. You show your driver's license, boom, you're in. It's not the third degree or anything.
It's time for our Mincing Rascals Campaign 2020 Digest. Now featuring snappy election music.
That was great.
What's the one that strikes your fancy the most, Eric? Is it the 1st Congressional District?
Well, yeah, I think the big political news of the week was certainly Bobby Rush saying he wasn't going to run for re-election. And then Alderman Pat Dowell has announced that she is getting out of the Secretary of State's race. She was in a four-way primary battle, and she wasn't doing all that well in that race, I don't think. And she just decided, well, she's going to automatically become, I think, the front runner for Bobby Rush's congressional seat. And once you get a congressional seat like that, you're kind of set as long as you want to be in a place like Chicago and Illinois. So that, to me, that was the biggest political story of the week.
How do we remember Bobby Rush?
I was just going to say that I think that lost in sort of all of the COVID craziness, it's really sort of lost with sort of just the huge end of an era it is that Bobby Rush is leaving Congress, because there are so many ways you can tell that story. You know, Bobby Rush, former Black Panther, right? Who was friends with Fred Hampton before he was, you know, murdered by the Chicago police and the FBI. And then you can tell the story about Bobby Rush being the only person to defeat Barack Obama in an election, who, you know, sort of withstood him. My Twitter, which I think tells you about what kind of a politics nerd I was, that everybody said, okay, Obama's going to run for Congress again and he can, you know, reclaim his loss. I suggested that he would not qualify as an Illinois resident as required, you know, and of course he helped fight apartheid in Congress. Huge legacy. You know, I cover Pat Dowell pretty consistently, and she is one of the workhorses of the city council. She led the budget negotiations. She's the chair of the budget committee. If she does win that seat, it will be a huge loss for the city council in terms of effective and competent committee leadership to get things done that the city council must get done. And I think it's really interesting that she is now the second member of the city council to announce a bid for Congress. Of course, Alderman Gil Villegas wants to represent the newly drawn district on the northwest side, which will have a majority of Latino residents, or Latino voters, I should say, which would mean, and he's also a committee chairman, which would mean that the city council potentially in 2023 or even sooner would look very, very different than it does right now.
I just want to point out that you can be a sitting alderman or alderperson and run for Congress, in this case, in 2022, and hang on to your seat. And if you don't win, you can run for re-election in 2023. So when we're talking about, like, who's going to run against Mayor Lightfoot, for instance, or who's going to run for some of these city positions, the alderman who decides to challenge Mayor Lightfoot would have to give up his or her seat at that point. So that, I think it's much more attractive. And by the same token, if you're in the state legislature, you're coming up for election in November 2022, which is when Bobby Rush's election would have been. Well, I mean, technically, I think the winner of the Democratic primary next year is going to win that seat. But in the 2022 election cycle, you would have a difficult time running for Congress and then turning around and running for the state legislature again. So it's very interesting that these two really powerful aldermen are thinking about and potentially making this move to Congress. I wasn't aware that they were as powerful as Heather said.
Jamal Cole, my block, my hood, my city.
I thought it was interesting. This was sort of like, do you remember when Rahm announced he was not going to run for re-election? And it actually gave a boost to people who got in before that was announced and said, oh, these people actually have principles and really want to run and are willing to challenge those in power. Whereas the cavalcade of folks who are coming in now would never have thought of such a thing. But it does seem, I believe he announced that he would, that Congressman Rush would announce an endorsement, which will carry a ton of weight. Right. And you would expect that person not to be someone who previously announced their candidacy.
How much attention should we spend to the, I'm reading from Wiki now, ethics concerns and conflicts of interest about Bobby Rush? He did not pay about $365,000 in rent for longtime use of an office to conduct politics. He's paid family members for years in questionable ways. Federal Election Commission questioned Rush's campaign over a campaign finance report that showed thousands of dollars spent on vague categories such as campaign visibility and services rendered. His wife, Carolyn, was paid $50,000 for consulting. His brother, Marlon, got $13,000 for 2 months' work on the campaign. And that's just the beginning. Currently, 15% of his pay is garnished to pay off a delinquent loan for his church.
What's been difficult and is probably a failing of the news media is because he has run essentially unopposed for so long that it is really difficult to sort of get into those details. And that, I think, is an argument for hoping that this is a robust primary and a robust general election, dare we dream, that will really allow, you know, sort of reporters to dig into and candidates to sort of, you know, go back and forth about what's best for this, you know, Southside congressional district, which is really sort of a really interesting part of Chicago right now, because it includes Bronzeville and the South Lakefront, which has seen a huge increase in population over the last 10 years, while at the same time having still some of the poorest parts of Chicago. And, you know, I would expect, you know, Michael Reese, that whole swath of land to be redeveloped in the next 10 years. So it will, you know, the population isn't going to trend in the other direction anytime soon. It's just, you know, really sort of, a weirdly uncharted territory, you know, literally minutes from the loop. And it'll be really exciting to see sort of what the visions for the candidates are.
How much did the district get redrawn in the latest maps? Did he get new territory, or did that district get new territory, lose territory?
He did. He wasn't, Bobby Rush was not happy with the map. He made no bones about that. He thought that, you know, and this was one of the areas that, you know, the General Assembly could have faced a challenge under the Voting Rights Act, because it is less African American now than it was. So I imagine that was part of his decision making as well. It extends much further south than I think his original district did, and he didn't want to. He was not interested in that, and his comments were very critical of it. So that no doubt played a role in this, and I think it will have an impact nationally too, because he is one of several members of the Congressional Black Caucus that have announced they will retire. So that power center in Washington, which of course was sort of overrepresented at times with Chicagoans and Illinoisans, that will change significantly.
Do you think there's seriously a chance that the fall election could be competitive then, given the way the district has been drawn?
Do I think that somebody like Pat Dowell is going to lead from day one until election day? I don't know, maybe, but she doesn't have a ton of money, and she does already have challengers like Jamal Cole, who's going to be out there, who's going to be talking about stuff, and who's going to be sort of raising progressive issues. Pat Dowell isn't an ideologue. She is not somebody who's out there campaigning for, you know, Medicare for all or anything like that. She is very much a workhorse and a constituent services first alderperson. How that translates to a congressional district run, I don't know, but she is very much in the mold of a Mike Quigley, who moved from the Cook County Board of Commissioners to replace Rahm Emanuel when he left to become Barack Obama's chief of staff back in 2013. And that is the role that she would play.
I have 11 minutes before I have to go to a meeting. I want to make sure we do a little on 9/11. 9/11, there I go. January 6th.
It's my birthday we're talking about, John. Come on. Don't confuse my birthday with 9/11. Thank you.
Well, let's just segue to that, Eric, and we'll spend still more time on all of these other races in our next podcast. But the FBI continues to look for and prosecute the January 6th insurrectionists. I don't think it was a grand organized conspiracy. I don't think it was a serious effort to overthrow the results of the election. if I were in a position to punish the people who are convicted, I would almost always hand down the most severe punishments. That may seem like a conflict, but it's because of what it was. It was a violent assault on the police and on the building and the idea of free and fair elections. But it was a ragtag group of knuckle chucks. Zorn, go.
Well, it wasn't, you say it wasn't a serious attempt. I think the people who were involved in it, and we're learning more and more that they actually did believe, the people who were part of the incursion into the Capitol, and also the people who were egging them on, did seriously hope that Mike Pence was going to withhold certification and that we were going to have essentially a coup. I mean, I think that they were dead serious about it, which is why, in retrospect, it still looks like such a horrifying day. They weren't very. It was incompetent. I'll give you that. But I'm not gonna let you get away with saying it wasn't serious. I think the people who were involved were very serious.
And I don't think we know yet the extent in which this may have been a conspiracy or not. You have Steve Bannon talking about how Mike Pence was the quarterback and Peter Navarro, who was still in the White House at the time, talking about that they had the playbook ready for how this was going to work. Did they specifically map out exactly where should people go? Were there congressmen or congresswomen giving tours to potential saboteurs in the days leading up to it? I don't know. That's where the investigation's going. Merrick Garland spoke today just before we went on. I think a lot of people, for some strange reason, were expecting him to come out guns blazing, but he was very Merrick Garland-y, as an attorney general should be. Just very, we're doing the work. We continue. We've arrested 700 some people. We have conspiracy charges or other charges. I shouldn't say conspiracy. I don't know for sure, but heavier charges on the way soon for other people. And we'll continue to do the work. So I think part of it is some people trying to capitalize on the movement saying, yeah, I was leading that like a Bannon type. Like, yeah, this was all part of the plan. Maybe they're trying to pump up their chest a little bit on what their role was. But I just ask anyone who maybe is already over it to go back and watch it. You don't have to watch some documentary about it. Just try and find footage of it as it happened live. And remember what you felt as it happened live. And remember that feeling. And to me, it was terrified. I made up a word there. I was terrified. I think we all were. There was a real fear that something really bad was about to happen. And that's how you should move forward with your thoughts on it. Not how things have changed the year.
John was talking before the show about all these nonfiction history books he was reading. And one of the things that always strikes me about history is the importance, not of these faceless historical forces per se that move throughout history. It's almost always stories about individual agency and how individual people acted. And that really determines how history moves forward rather than, some kind of grand narrative. And I think I talked about this on the show before, but Mike Pence had a lot on his shoulders in making that decision to certify the election results. He was getting pressure from the most powerful people in the country not to certify them. And he chose to do that. And I think that is a good lesson in courage, at least in that one individual act that I often think about, and how much different our country would be right now had that gone the other way.
Do we give people credit for not overturning a Democratic election?
Yes, I do. I do.
Yeah, he chose, I guess. Yeah.
I know, Heather. I know it seems strange, but I do give him credit. I give Bill Barr credit for coming forward and saying, and it pissed off Trump, that there was no fraud in the election. I mean, those were important things. I give credit to the Republican in Michigan on the canvas board who voted to certify the election. I mean, there's little things, and people have made big mistakes in the past, and I disagree, but they stood up in moments that were important.
Yeah. Dan Quayle was a hero because he talked Pence off the ledge.
I would encourage everybody to read Peril by Bob Costa and Bob Woodward. The argument of that book is that what we saw on January 6th, the insurrection at the Capitol, was one prong of three-pronged attempt to overturn a Democratic election, and that it wasn't just stopping Pence. That was one avenue. There were also all of the court cases, and then there was an effort to get state legislatures led by Republicans to decertify their electoral college votes. So I don't think that there's evidence to show that the insurrection was a bunch of chuckleheads. I think that there is a significant amount of evidence to show that it was clearly coordinated by people in the White House and adjacent to the White House. Merrick Garland's speech today, which I was skimming during this podcast, I think it makes it clear that there is a lot that we don't know, that we don't know, just like in every federal investigation, that, you know, keeps me up at night when it's my job to report on federal investigations.
I just, can I just add that, I know these federal investigations take time, but we don't have that much time. The Congress is almost certainly going to flip to Republican, well, I guess in January, after the November elections. And at that point, there's just all the administration and Merrick Garland, they're all going to be sort of more, much more paralyzed. It's going to be that we need to gather, we being the Congress, people who are investigating this, they need to gather as much information as they can, as soon as they can. But then we can't have this, like, this process is playing out like in the Burke.
You can't rush it either. You can't make it look political and rush it. And the DOJ will continue to operate with Merrick Garland in charge for 2 years after the midterms.
I hope so.
True.
I appreciate what you said, Heather, but I also think that all three of those prongs were run by knucklechucks. Play out for me, all of you, any of you, or all of you can do this, the scenario by which one of those prongs was successful, and now Donald Trump is still president. We would have a civil war before that would happen. I mean, I cannot imagine a scenario where today Donald Trump is president.
You're putting a lot of faith in our institutions, yeah. Which, I mean, they've withstood a lot, and a lot more serious, a lot, you know, things of equal weight of that and even greater. But you can't know for certain. I think we saw how fragile they were.
And there is an effort around the country to replace secretaries of state and other elections officials with partisan hacks.
There was an effort. By whom? And how serious were those efforts?
I'm saying there
who
was.
Were those people?
Okay, well,
look what's happened since, though, John. It's
yes, exactly.
Continued.
That's what I'm talking about. What's going to happen in 2024 if all of a sudden in Arizona and Georgia and Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin, you've got these hacks running the election? They all say, oh, well, there's too many questions about this. We're going to let our state legislature send the send the votes to the Electoral College. That could happen. And that's what people were worried about. You know, that's what Trump was asking them to do in Georgia, saying, look, find me some votes. And so I can easily imagine a situation where if you have enough corrupt people in those positions of power over elections, that they can just declare them null and void. So, yeah, it looks like the popular vote belonged to Democrats, but we think there were too many irregularities. We're going to award our electoral votes to the Republican.
I think my hope is not that Republicans or even Trump acolytes don't win or have power, but that corrupt people don't, because ultimately that's what you need. You need corrupt people to run everything. And I think I'm idealistic enough to believe that we're not there. What do you
look
think
at the vote, John? Look at the vote in Congress right after the insurrection. The vast majority of Republicans voted not to certify those votes. I mean, I don't know if corrupt is the right word. If that's a word you want to use for that, but that's the word I would use to describe that particular vote, that particular stance on this election. I think the stance right now, people saying that the election was won by Donald Trump and not Joe Biden is a corrupt position, corrupted by worldview, that one that is very dangerous to democracy.
I know more than 50% of Republicans believe that Donald Trump should be president of the United States when they ask them. I still don't believe that. I think most Republicans know Joe Biden is the legitimate president. And when they're asked in surveys, they say that other thing. That's the little world I've created for myself, everybody. It's a great place.
It's where I own the libs by telling that pollster no.
Yeah, I think
I agree with that.
I wish I had more time to say stupid things, but we're out of time. Heather, thanks for joining us. Austin, John, Eric, I'm John Williams. This is The Mincing Rascals. We're produced by a man named Pete Zimmerman and Ashley Byhunt. We'll drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.
We'll be right back.